King Henry III ruled for a bloody long time. Elevated to the throne as a child, he'd remained king for a staggering 56 years and 19 days. Technically, this makes him the fifth longest reigning monarch in British history, beaten only by James I or James VI of Scotland, George III, Victoria, and of course, Elizabeth II. It's a measure of how bloody long he's been in power that in this podcast, he came to the throne back in chapter 86, and for the last 13 episodes, everything has been focused on him. I even gave his eulogy back in chapter 96, and still he's hanging around. Well, we now finally reach his final years, and I do not want to talk about this broken and sickly old man, now in his 60s. I want to talk about London during the final few years of his perpetually unstable reign. It was a London that was to see more violence on the streets. Literally, battles raged between the residents of the city. It was a London of massive social division, a London of chaos and political argument, a London of great floods and worse disasters. It was a place where the battles which had started a few years before carried on, but were reduced to the shadows. Out of sight of historians studying the entire nations, but very much apparent to those living in the city. Hi, my name is Saul, and this is The Story of London, the podcast dedicated to telling the history of the city. As I go along and tell its story, I try to turn it into a grand narrative, which means yes, I do go into a lot of detail, but no, not as much as if I decided to turn it into a pure, straight academic historical interpretation. And this is the 100th chapter of the story. I started this project nearly 2 years ago, and guess what? I'm still going, and I've got a ways to go yet. By way of celebrating episode 100, this week I'm doing a doubleheader, 2 episodes in 7 days. And I'd like to welcome you to this special episode dedicated to basically getting Henry III out of the way and describing London's very intense life during these few years. Grab a coffee, get comfy, and welcome to chapter 100 of The Story of London, The Shadow Wars of London. While I like each episode of the story to stand alone, meaning you can just listen and enjoy it by itself, this chapter does talk about people and events whose tales began in previous episodes. We start with the final part of the story of Thomas FitzThomas. In case you haven't listened to any previous episode, Thomas FitzThomas was the 4-time mayor of London and was arguably the most controversial mayor the city had yet seen so far. He was a popularist. Born into the wealthy oligarch class of London, who had chosen the mayors and sheriffs of the city for, well, for as long as there'd been mayors and sheriffs of the city, Thomas FitzThomas had turned his back on his people and had appealed to the people. FitzThomas remains the first mayor of London who gained his political support and mandate from the general people, the commons of the city. He was a radical. He'd been charismatic. And he'd been the man who had led London into forming a grand alliance with Simon de Montfort and the city committing itself to the grand rebellion against the king. And because of that, he'd spent the last few years locked up in Windsor Castle, by now the symbol of Plantagenet brutality, and, well, let's put it like this, in this era, Windsor was the nemesis of London. But in 1268, in the spirit of reconciliation that the king was allowing because of the political solutions to the rebellion of the Earl of Gloucester, Thomas FitzThomas was released. Records say that he had to pay a large personal fine of about £500 to gain that release, but that he, along with Thomas de Pewillisden, the man who had been elected Constable of London and had organised its citizens into a militia which had taken battle across the south of England, were both released back into London. His political career was certainly over. But even though FitzThomas had escaped any future punishment, there were many in the oligarch class and richer citizens in London who resented the living hell out of this man. And while they could not strike back at him, legally or physically, they could still assassinate his character. And one of the men who hated him most of all, Arnold Thietmar, a.k.a. Arnold Thedmar, a.k.a. Arnold Fitz Thedmar. Who was he? Well, he was a German-born resident of London. He'd come to the city as a German merchant based in the Stahlhof, the steelyard, the enclave of Germans down at Dowgate Docks, owned by the Germans and ran by the Germans. It was a series of warehouses and other buildings which allowed them to offload their goods for importing into England, and it was the end part of a trading link that had been established from places like Cologne. It was a self-governing region of the city. They elected their own aldermen and had been granted the right to police their own neighbourhood. Arnold had risen to become a leading figure in the Stahlhof, and as such a figure of respect within the circles of the oligarchs who ran London. And more than that, he hated Thomas FitzThomas. And that in and unto itself wouldn't be anything to record in a podcast, except Arnold was a recorder of history. He recorded many of the events in this city at the time, and indeed, for the last dozen chapters or so, it's been his records I've used as I tried to piece together the events of the city at the time. But it's worth keeping in mind that Arnold was never an impartial historian. He was just a man, a political creature, a person who spluttered with indignation upon the pages when he found himself accused of crimes, and a man who was not above getting a level of revenge upon Thomas FitzThomas via his chosen medium. Arnold decided to take out FitzThomas with the best weapon he had, his words. And thus, around about the time FitzThomas was released from prison, Arnold writes the following, quote, "Hence it is that it not ought to be passed over in silence, what wickedness and what cruelty Thomas FitzThomas and Thomas de Pewilsden and their iniquitous accomplices, amid the many evils which they had committed during the commotions in the Kingdom of England, thought to perpetuate and hoped to carry out into effect," unquote. Yeah, he was going to accuse him of a crime that he almost committed. And so without evidence, without any corroboration, and without allowing the two Thomases any right to reply, Arnold paints for us a picture of the situation in London just after the Battle of Lewes. He claims that, quote, "The before-named Thomas and Thomas and other wicked persons, holding conference amongst themselves, whether or not at the command of the Earl of Leicester, I know not, made arrangement, and by oath confirmed the same, that suddenly and unexpectedly they would put to death about 40 of the most lawful men of the city, and this because they were faithful to his lordship the king and to Sir Edward his son," unquote. Maybe this was so. Maybe with Prince Edward in the field and the Earl of Gloucester now potentially swapping sides against the Earl of Leicester, they decided unilaterally to purge London of the leading men of the city. Or maybe considering the king was still the hostage of de Montfort, and he was kept so close to de Montfort that in the aftermath of the Battle of Evesham, reports say the king had to scream at the rampaging and murderous forces of his son not to confuse him with the other men around him they were killing, maybe de Montfort's defeat was not an inevitability. But whatever the case, Arnold claims that back then, on August 1st that year, quote, "the whole of the community was summoned to appear at the Guildhall, and so amongst them the men aforesaid might be seized and immediately put to death. Accordingly, on that day the wicked persons before mentioned came there with arms beneath their clothes, their accomplices rushing in troops, ready and prepared with swords and other arms to perpetuate the felony aforesaid, when, behold, news came of the battle which had been fought at Evesham on the Tuesday preceding, and upon hearing which, these wicked men of Belial abandoned their design, and so on that day the innocent blood was saved," unquote. Behold, it is the hand of God that saved them. Yeah, right, mate. The suspected victims, by the way, is a who's who of several of the people running London at the moment. We see, quote, "John de Guisors, William FitzRichard, John Adrian Draper, William de Durham, Juggery de Rooksale, Reginald de Suffolk, Arnold Thredmar, Robert de Cornhill, Geoffrey de Winchester, John Durkin, Bartholomew de Chestel," unquote. Oh, look, these happen to just be the men in charge of London at the moment. With John Adrian, who'd been many times bailiff of London for the king, and Fitz Richard, four times mayor of said city, and whose pro-royal sentiments had been so strong that, as I mentioned last chapter, his re-elevation to the position of mayor had actually been delayed by a year. We do know that one of the Thomases, Thomas de Pilsden and Geoffrey de Chastel, had gotten into a physical fight at some point in the past, with, quote, the said Bartholomew taking the part of Sir Edward and the other one the part of the Earl of Leicester, unquote. And this all leads to a simple question: was this accusation true? As you may be able to tell, I for one don't think it is. The peevish bias of Arnold runs throughout his account of things. But I cannot say with certainty that he was lying, so I'm including the allegation in the podcast. And besides, the fact that the allegation exists for me is more important, as it proves that while a few years had passed, the recent political turmoil in London, which it had faced over these years, was still cooking. People resented the living hell out of which side their neighbours took in the preceding political arguments. And we know that Arnold calling the former mayor an alleged attempted mass murderer wasn't even the peak of it. These passions were causing all-out war on the streets of London. We read that around the 25th of November, quote, that a dispute arose between certain of the craft of goldsmiths and certain of the craft of tailors, unquote. Now, before we go any further, it wasn't just goldsmiths v. tailors. Other professions were involved, because according to Arnold, that along with these two professions were also, quote, to whom adhered on one side or the other, some of the trade of parmenters and some of the toyers, unquote. Which described members of a type of shoemaker in London, the toyers, who prepared fine leather shoes with alum, and the parmenters are men who work with parmentary cloth or broadcloth. If you look at the sides, one of these professions does stand out, the goldsmiths, those who dealt with the import and export of bullion and the fashioning of it. These are the remnants of London's moneyers. And we know from their adultering guild records, something we actually mentioned all the way back in chapter 80 of the story, that they were usually quite rich, and at the most basic level, when you see goldsmiths, you see them to be representatives of the oligarch faction. But as evidence will suggest this chapter, the professions and the cause of the conflict was never a cut and dried thing. We cannot say for sure that the reason for the fight between these two large bodies of men was their allegiance to either the king or the Earl of Leicester a few years before. But it would make sense if it was. Without that reason, we have to assume they were fighting over some other reason never once mentioned or hinted at in any London records. And so unless they were falling out over, as far as I can tell, the regulation of the size of fishing nets on the River Thames, which had been the only issue that had come up in the year or so previous, it just makes sense that they're falling out because of the rebellions that went on previously. And the fact that it wasn't just goldsmiths and tailors involved means it's not just a guild thing. So all of this suggests what we're seeing was a row between supporters of the Commons, the grand campaign of Thomas FitzThomas, and supporters of the Royalists, the advocates of Mayor Thomas FitzWilliam. And things got serious really quickly, because records say that these, quote, persons held great assemblages, and for 3 nights together went armed through the streets of the city, creating most severe conflicts amongst themselves, unquote. So here they're armed and seeking each other out. This is political violence stalking the night streets of London. And this was not some small altercation. Quote, hence, without doubt, as was said, more than 500 of these mischievous persons were collected together at night, and in the affray, many of them were wounded. For everyone was wanting by force of arms to take vengeance on his adversary against the peace and his own fealty to his lordship the king, unquote. 500 men driven by bad blood. Vengeance was in the air. In this account of the story of London, I am claiming that these men are being driven by the political feuds that had gone on previously. Because don't forget, we've seen homes looted, people in prisons, reputations ruined. This was bad blood. This was a London civil war in the shadows. And for 3 nights, carnage reigned upon the narrow streets of the city. Eventually, quote, the bailiffs and discreet men of the city, understanding which, had more than 30 of them seized and imprisoned in Newgate. And these, by the Friday next after the Feast of St. Catherine, appeared before Lawrence de Brock, the justiciar assigned, who took proceedings against them in the king's behalf, saying that they, against the peace, had gone armed in the city, and had at night wickedly and feloniously wounded some persons, and had slain others, whose bodies, it was said, had been thrown into the Thames, unquote. So we get an idea of just how serious this conflict was from the court case. According to this, men had been murdered and their bodies thrown into the Thames. This was a veritable night war upon the streets of London. Now, the accused in this court case, quote, denied violence and injury, unquote. But there was more to this than just who was in the right and who was in the wrong. There was order needing to be maintained. And so more than 30 men were, quote, immediately hanged, although not one among them had been convicted of homicide, mayhem, or robbery, unquote. There is a sense that whatever the excuse they were going to use, the official response from the authorities was simply to end the violence come what may, using brutality as their judicial weapon of choice. And the records say they did not care if there were a few borderline miscarriages of justices along the way. The records themselves highlight the case of a man called, quote, Geoffrey, surnamed de Beverley, a parmenter by trade, because certain of these misdoers had armed themselves in his house, and he himself had been present with them in arms in the said affray, was hanged together with 12 others who had been indicted, as well as goldsmiths and parmenters and toyers. All of this, however, was done that others, put in awe thereby, might take warning. And so the peace of his lordship the king by all within the city might be more rigidly maintained, unquote. So Geoffrey de Beverley was involved in the fight, but again, no conviction of murder or even assault, but they hung him anyway. The night war of London was stopped dead. But it did show that the Crown's authority was still tenuous at best. Steps needed to be taken to stabilise the city, and steps were to be, as we will see. By 1269, we read that on August the 1st, quote, the King of Almaine departed from London to pass over to his kingdom, unquote. Oh, look, Richard, the Earl of Cornwall, who had been nominated the King of the Germans, was finally returning back to Germany after years of being in England and shoring up his brother's rule. Like, there's a huge amount of tolerance for this king being shown by the Germans right now, I feel. And a few other things went down in 1269. The resentment towards the richer elements of the city continued, with the warden of the exiled Bishop of London calling, quote, upon the parish priests of the city, that they may pronounce certain of the chief men of the city aforesaid excommunicated, because they received probate of testaments as to the lands and tenements devised, unquote. There was a legal thing. Somebody in the church authority said, let's excommunicate the rich guys who are prosecuting this legal thing, and the rich guys then appealed to the king over this, and he stopped this excommunication dead in its tracks. And meanwhile, don't forget, during all of this, London was still paying off the staggering record fine of over £13,000 to the king for their part in the rebellion of Simon de Montfort. And I mention this because right now we have an epic case of tax evasion. You see, it's recorded, quote, that many persons of the city of London left the city, along with their goods, that nothing could be found whereby they could be distrained to raise proportional size upon them, unquote. So, the tax bill was due to help pay off this record fine. And there are folks basically leaving the city and taking everything with them. So when it came to assessing how much money does this person owe, they just weren't around and there were no goods, and therefore you can't tax them. And London was like, oh, you little shits about these folks, and they appealed to the king. And the king happily obliged them, and a writ went out across England saying, quote, certain persons of our city of London have departed from the same city with their merchandise and goods and chattels, seeking subterfuges therein, whereby they may clandestinely escape paying the tallage upon them assessed in regards to the fine of 20,000 marks, which our citizens of said city have made unto us for having our goodwill, unquote. The king did not like being cheated of his cash, and so went on to say, quote, we have granted unto the same our citizens that the goods and chattels of the persons who have so left the city aforesaid, wheresoever the same in our realm may happen to be found, may be arrested until they have fully made satisfaction as to the tallage upon them assessed. And we do therefore command you that you cause to be seized the merchandise, goods and chattels wheresoever in the same of our realm may happen to be found until they shall have fully paid, unquote. Give me my money, London. I want my money, London. I want you to make sure everyone pays me my money, London. Eventually, however, it seems as if old Henry III realised that London was a bit too much for him to cope with. As we've been covering from roughly chapter 87, London had been a place of continual frustration for the king. It had vexed him countless times. Every time the old king had gotten any money out of the place, it had found a way to confound him. You get the feeling Henry III was done. He wanted and needed someone else to deal with London. Someone who could take the city by the scruff of the neck. Someone who wasn't going to stand for any nonsense from the place. There, waiting in the wings, was his son and heir, Edward. Furious, dynamic Edward, brutal Edward, a man whose singular contribution to London's body politic so far had been to find as many of the Londoners as he could at the Battle of Lewes, men such as William Grapefig, and then kill them. Edward, who had never forgiven London for throwing things at his mother, Prince Edward Longshanks. Oh, he was more than willing to take over this city. 1269, therefore, started badly for London. We read that from November the 30th the year before, quote, there was a most severe winter and a great frost, unquote, which lasted until February the 2nd. And on top of this, that January, while this was going on, quote, in this year, the water of the Thames arose on the feast of St. Vincent, reaching a greater height than it had been done in the time of any person then living, so much so that many manors, houses and even men were overwhelmed by inundation, unquote. So around January 22nd, the city was flooded badly. Manors and houses suggest the region between the city and Westminster suffered as well, and from the description, this flood caused fatalities. And then, just as it was recovering from this, 1269 gets worse. Quote, this year, in the first week of Lent, His Lordship the King delivered unto Sir Edward his son the city of London and the Tower, who thereupon immediately made Sir Hugh Fitz-Oates constable of the Tower and warden of the city, unquote. Oof. Well, clearly there's a new sheriff in town, only it wasn't the sheriff at all, it was the old constable, Sir Hugh Fitz-Oates. He'd been placed in charge of London immediately after the fall of the de Montfort regime, and now he was back. And he answered directly to Prince Edward. London would have gotten the political message from that appointment really fast. However, Edward, as the Lord of London, meant suddenly London had an active political figure in charge of it, for the first time in ages. For the first time in decades, the named royal overseeing the city was not the useless Henry III. It was his very much less crap son. And this, This gave London a window, a pragmatic opportunity, a way in. See, allow me to explain. The London records state that, quote, "His Lordship the King, this time 3 years before, had granted unto Sir Edward, his son, to take custom of all things coming by sea into England and from England going forth," unquote. So around 1266, Prince Edward had been able to gain his own revenues from his father by being entirely in charge of the revenues from the nation's import and exports. Got it? Awesome. However, Edward wasn't really a merchant at all, but he knew merchants, and thus we read, quote, "Such custom had been leased unto certain Italians upon yearly payment to Sir Edward of a firm of 6,000 marks," unquote. So Edward had smartly placed the power to run Britain's import and export industry into the hands of a bunch of Italian merchants, and then could charge these Italian merchants an absolute fortune to run it for them. And they paid, because, you know, it was Edward. So where did the Italians make their money? Well, as the London residents had noted over the preceding 3 years, quote, "The said Italians extracted the same custom of the citizens of London and took sureties of them in contravention of their franchises," unquote. And, you know, the London residents had to take this exploitation by the Italians because they were doing it for Prince Edward, and Prince Edward thought London and Londoners could go eat a bag of dicks. But now London was under Prince Edward directly. So any loss of their revenue could be a loss to his revenues. And so we see, emerging from the shadows, the very savvy citizens of the city going, quote, "to Sir Edward, and begged of him that he would not allow such a yoke of servitude be imposed upon them, in contravention of the franchises by the charters of his lordship the king his father, and of his predecessors, kings of England, unto them granted," unquote. Oh, you can see the arguments here, can't you? "Honestly, your majesty, this money we pay to the Italians, your father and grandfather and great-grandfather, they never imposed this. We would have given that money to them." Guess what? This line worked. Quote, "Whereupon Sir Edward, at their entreaty, granted unto them acquittance of the custom aforesaid," unquote. Oh, this is good. Immediately having Edward in charge means that London's trade positions can be improved. And indeed, the domination of London's trade by foreigners, which we've been covering for many episodes now began to change. Edward saw the prudence in getting London's merchants into profit-making order, turning London into a nice regular source of income for himself. And so London and the Londoners suddenly realised that Edward, this prince who hated the city, could actually be useful in solving many of the city's economic issues. And the biggest of which was foreign merchants. Now, not all the foreign merchants, no. The Germans and the Stalloff, who did things like import grain during the famines of early years, they were kind of exempt, but the Italians and the Cahorsins and the other merchants of Provence, you see, yes, because they were up to something. You see, quote, "When a great number of merchants from the parts aforesaid, who were extremely rich, had brought into the city a very great authority of merchandise, in order that the amount of such wares might remain unknown to the citizens, they declined to be harboured in the hostels of the citizens, but built houses in the city, and abode therein by themselves, housing there their goods," unquote. You may remember, I mentioned this a long time ago in a previous chapter. Even back to Anglo-Saxon days, the basic rule of traders coming to London was that you had to, within the city, and this was the law and ordinance of the city, take up residence in a Londoner's house. This way, the London resident, who is usually a merchant, would not only host you, they could see the merchandise you were bringing in. The London merchants effectively operated as customs and excise. However, the merchants of Italy and southern France were bypassing London's custom checks, by building their own houses, which allowed them to hide the goods they were taking in. And when they were not hiding them, they were lying about how much they were shipping in. Quote, weighing by balances off their own, they sold their wares contrary to the custom of the city, and even went so far as themselves to weigh by their own balances certain articles which were sold by the hundredweight, which ought to be weighed by the king's balance, to the prejudice of his lordship the king, and to the loss and subtraction of his pressage. And this they did for many years, unquote. So, yeah, the records say that they were ripping off London. But now London could say, well, they're technically ripping off Prince Edward. And of course, Prince Edward and his father were paying attention. The royal authorities reminded everyone what the laws were, that everybody should be measuring by the king's measure of weight of goods. But the Londoners slyly pointed out that, quote, these merchants, nevertheless, continued to weigh as they had previously done, unquote. And from the shadows, it appears that London was able to direct the anger of the king now away from them, but upon the foreign merchants who had acted like they ran the city for years. The king acted fast. Quote, his bailiffs, in accordance with his command, took all the balances and weights off the said merchants, and upon good sureties, attached the persons themselves. Thereafter on this year, his lordship the king summoned the said merchants to appear before himself and his council at Westminster. And because they were convicted of having weighed by their balances against the king's prohibition, and because their balances and weights were examined in the king's exchange, were found, it is said, to be untrue, they were adjudged to be immersed, immediately upon which, being about 20 in number, they were taken to the Tower and there imprisoned. On the morrow, too, their balances and weights were burnt in Westcheap, and such parts thereof that could not be consumed by fire were broken into pieces with iron hammers and wholly destroyed, unquote. You can imagine the cheers. The Italian merchants and those sodding courtesans were now locked up in the Tower, and their dodgy weights and measures destroyed physically in front of everybody on Cheapside. That would have been a hell of a good party that day. Things were being done. Having Edward in charge does seem to have started to solve some long-standing grievances. Hey, maybe having Prince Edward in charge of London wasn't so bad, right? Well, no, to be honest. Edward being in charge, well, he was still Edward. He still bore a huge grudge towards the city. And before 1269 ended, we see that manifested. So it's worth noting that around the 6th of December that year, a writ was sent, quote, unto the warden, bailiffs, and aldermen of the city, in which it was set forth that he commanded that all those who, after the city had been restored to him, had withdrawn themselves through fear of losing life or limb, and had since returned, should be expelled from the city, that so by them the venom might not again be diffused throughout the city, unquote. Here was a list, upon which were the names of those who'd been pivotal to the de Montfort rebellion and the aftermath of the de Clare rebellion. I'd mentioned these in previous chapters. These are the men who'd been either exiled from London or had fled from there in the aftermath of the defeat and then had returned. And the king, and above all his son, were not done with these men. They were the enemy. Despite the king's promise after de Clare's rebellion to no longer go after London or any Londoners for their actions during those eras, Edward had made no such promise, it seems, and if he had, he was in no mind to keep it. He had a list and a shadow campaign. A shadow inquisition was about to be initiated. Quote, whereupon, after the warden, bailiffs, and all the aldermen had met together, and the aforesaid writ had been read and understood, the warden produced a certain roll which he had received in the wardrobe of his lordship the king, in which were written the names of many persons, during the commotions in the kingdom, voluntarily adhered to the Earl of Leicester, committing depredations within the city and without, unquote. In secret, in the shadows, the city-based Inquisition apprehended all these men, whose venom was so feared. They were arrested and tried in secret, and the records say that, quote, duly examined, the persons were subjected to inquiry, and their names entered into a certain roll. After this, on the fourth day before our Lord's Nativity, a countless multitude of people of the city meeting together in the chamber of the Guild Hall, this matter was made known. And the aforesaid writ was read of His Lordship the King, the names also being read of those who were to be removed from the city, to which matter the whole populace gave its assent, unquote. And it was done. The purge of London. The new regime of Prince Edward is extracting its price from the city. And when you look upon that list, you can't help but notice that these dangerous radicals, they were rather mundane men. The first name on the list is Thomas Dipper Wilsdon, the most famed of them. The former constable of London, the man who had organised its military forces as it had burned down the estates of the king's brother in Isleworth, had besieged Rochester Castle, had stood on the fields of Lewes to face down the cavalry led by Prince Edward. But other names show the diversity of this group, these supposed dangerous revolutionaries. Richard Le Cofferer was by his name the maker of coffers or small boxes. Ivo Le Lingedripper was most likely a linen draper by profession, while William de Florna was a baker of some description, supposedly specialising in making small cakes. He and his servant Guido were named on that list and exiled. You see mercers on it, like William de Basings and William May, and goldsmiths like John Fitzpatrick and men called Conrad and another called Hubert. There is someone whose name sounds like a nickname, Cock le Effet, a.k.a. Cock the Dandy or Cook the Affected, may be suggesting a larger-than-life character, but alongside him is just listed his brother with the rather mundane name, John. Alexander Le Ferron was probably an ironmonger. Everard Le Batteur was a fuller of cloth, while Hawking Le Plumeur appears to have been a feathermonger, or a seller of feathers, which sounds like a brilliant job. Almost as fascinating as William de Bixil, who is described as a stockfishmonger. Some of the radicals were identified by where they lived. John de Ostrigit's name suggests he was from Watergate on Thames, the lane near the north end of the bridge. Some sound respectable, Master Guido the Tailor, for example. While John de Flit, the barber, sounds like he lived over near the Fleet River. We have men employed working for the church, like William the Clerk, a deacon. We have butchers like Colin Brianti and fishmongers like Peter de Haywood. And there, amidst men with glorious names like Richard Wombstrong, we find men whose entry suggests perhaps a much deeper story, like the man listed as Eadmund, who was with Stephen Buckerell. Given Buckerell was a marshal of London's forces, leading them into battle alongside Thomas de Pewillisden, one has to wonder, was this his aide-de-camp? Or was he his bodyguard? And speaking of Thomas de Pewillisden, there is lower down on this list of names the hint that this purge of London was targeting his entire family. Again, we cannot be sure, but there seems to be an entry for Roger de Pewillisden and Richard, his brother. Were they brothers of Thomas? Was the whole family being targeted in this purge? These names and more were the men exiled from the city. Quote, proclamation was made all through the city that those names should be read before the people in manner already stated, should, if then in the city, betake themselves away from it, never to return, while those who were then sojourning without the city were for the future never to return to it, under pain of life and limb, unquote. The London of Prince Edward was sorting out all old business, clearing the books, wiping the slates clean whether you like it or not. Edward had control of London, the hated London, the city which had insulted his mother so gravely, but he also wanted the city to get its shit together. And so, with the main political agitators of the Commons, now either exiled or the former mayor Thomas FitzThomas, keeping their heads down and being quiet like good little boys, he decided that London needed a more stable leadership. And we read in the record, quote, at the instance of Sir Edward, his lordship the king, granted the citizens that they might have a mayor from amongst themselves in such form as they were wont to elect him. He also granted unto them they may have two sheriffs from amongst themselves, who would hold the sheriffwick of the city and of Middlesex to firm in such manner as they'd previously been wont, unquote. Well, would you look at that? London is getting its mayor and sheriff back. Of course, Edward was no idiot. The only way this deal was going to happen was because it was based, quote, upon the understanding, however, that whereas in past times they'd only paid the yearly £300 sterling, in future they should pay yearly £400 sterling counted out, unquote. Yep, the city's annual tax bill was raised to 400 quid a year, but it's a tidy sum for the heir of the throne, and of course London paid. Quote, accordingly in the same week, the citizens chose John Adrian Draper to be mayor of the city, and Philip Le Tillor and Walter Le Potter to be sheriffs of the city, unquote. Ah, John Adrian, the draper who had spent so long holding various bailiff posts during the preceding years. He was a proper royalist yes-man, and now he was mayor. Thus, 1270 dawned, and the new sheriffs and mayor immediately got back to the standard business of trying to run London. During all of the tumult and chaos of the 1260s, certain things had been allowed to fall by the wayside. The great pillory on Cheapside, where bakers and brewers who were guilty of short change could be punished, had started to fall apart. The Londoners did complain the pillory was no longer able to be used the year before, and we see the first thing the new administration did, quote, these sheriffs immediately after the Feast of St. Michael had a new pillory made and erected it in the place where the old pillory had previously stood, unquote. And then, in 1270, something incredibly profound happened, really staggering important for the city of London and its future. But it's such an obscure thing, it's almost always overlooked in the histories of the time. London was about to be given a huge economic adrenaline shot. And to understand that, we need to very briefly explain right now why the aged King Henry III had a falling out with the Countess of Flanders, Margaret II. See, Margaret II had ruled Flanders now for about 26 years after her father had died on crusade. And she had strode across northwestern Europe as a power in her own right, known to many salaciously as Margaret the Black. But economically, she was responsible for turning the city of Bruges into an international trading heavyweight. She had granted trading privileges to the merchants of Castilia, Gascony and Puiton, and under her, the Flemish had become the key players in the northern European cloth industry. Flemish merchants bought up the majority of English wool, and their linen outsold and outcompeted the English competition. However, back during de Montfort's takeover, she had actually demanded payments from the English government, which was doing everything in the king's name, don't forget, to continue trading with England in the face of all this instability. De Montfort had got the king to agree and put his seal to it and had approved the deal. And I am simplifying this, but basically afterwards, Henry claimed that due to the fact that the previous deal had been done in bad faith, he did not see the need to continue this payment to the ruler of the Flemish traders for them to keep on trading. Margaret responded to this news with a declaration of economic war. In what was the first serious trade war England had witnessed since the era of Offa the Great's falling out with Charlemagne, which I covered all the way back in chapter 6, Margaret seized possession of English merchant goods in Flanders. And the king responded in kind. And, quote, after council had been held by order of his lordship the king, all chattels belonging to the merchants of Flanders were taken and seized, which, however, were but few in number, because they, being forewarned by the countess, had sent nearly all of their goods out of the kingdom, unquote. Having been vexed like this, the English regime responded forcefully, however, and, quote, it was forbidden by writ of his lordship the king, sent to London and to all the seaports, that any person, whether native or alien, should take any wool out of the realm to parts beyond sea. And so it was accordingly done, unquote. A full-scale trade embargo was emplaced upon all wool exports from England. The wool trade was closed out. This full embargo was kept in place until a later Parliament of Westminster gathered that October, where a proper response could be found. And it was then ruled, quote, that all merchants, except of Flanders, might carry wool out of the kingdom, whithersoever they might think proper. Flanders excepted. Unquote. Wool exports had been turned on, except to Flanders. The Flemish were now closed off from England's wool. Quote, and then by the king's order, all the merchants who were in London appeared before the council at Westminster, and there made oath that they would carry no wool to Flanders, nor would have any fellowship with the Flemings, or sell them any wool, unquote. And this was done to the London merchants especially, because, as I mentioned in previous chapters, there were a bunch of London-based merchants who had been making money acting as middlemen to these Flemish wool merchants. The trade embargo of the Flemish merchants had begun. Most importantly, the events of 1270 had allowed London-based merchants regain a foothold in the English wool trade, and it effectively crippled the power of the Flemish cloth trade. Now, this wasn't much of an economic rebuilding block for London, but it was a start, a way to rebuild and regain the power they used to have. The year passes on. John Adrian began his second term of mayor, and we enter 1271, and then disaster. On January 25th, quote, suddenly and unexpectedly, a great part of the tower of the Church of St. Mary Arches in London fell to the ground in Cheap, unquote. The steeple of a church on Cheapside fell to the ground. And even though it's called St. Mary Arches, the actual church we're talking about is St. Mary Le Bow. And the sudden collapse of the steeple of the church that January morning in 1271 was not the first calamity to hit that particular church. If you remember all the way back in chapter 54, I described the tornado which fell upon London in 1091, which had torn the roof off the church. Well, the church had been rebuilt, but just over 100 years later in 1196, St. Mary Le Bow had been the location of the final standoff between the powers of the Archbishop of Canterbury and William FitzOsbert, whose story I covered all the way back in chapter 79. And during that standoff, the church had been burnt. The roof of this church had been effectively rebuilt twice, and I guess it doesn't really take much imagination to imagine that medieval church building standards are not entirely brilliant. And with this, the replacement steeple finally just gave up the ghost, possibly during some bad weather that January, and came crashing down upon the street below. By the way, the reason why the church was called St. Mary Arches was because, as regular listeners hopefully will remember, all the way back in chapter 51, I mentioned how the Church of St. Mary de Abacus had been set up on this location by the then Archbishop of Canterbury Lanfranc, and since then it had been part of the diocese of the Archbishop of Canterbury as opposed to the Bishop of London, and that originating in its basement had been the appellate court of the Archbishop, the Court of Arches, hence why it's known as St. Mary Arches. And any which way you look at it, the collapse on Cheapside of the steeple of St. Mary Le Bow was a big thing. And according to our account by Arnold, quote, more than 20 persons, men and women, were killed, unquote. Would have been a heck of a disaster. However, the business of London never stands still for long. You may remember how a few chapters ago when I was describing the Battle of Lewes and the build-up to it, I described how the Queen of England had been bombarded with insults and stones from the residents of London. Well, one of the things the King had done after the whole de Montfort rebellion was finished was that he had, quote, granted unto his Queen the custody of London Bridge, which custody she held in her hands for nearly 6 years, and removing the wardens appointed by the citizens, placed their wardens at her own option, unquote. So as punishment for that day, London Bridge was now the sole property of the Queen of England, Queen Eleanor. Now she used this to her own benefit and, quote, collected all issues of the rents and lands of the said bridge, converting the same to I know not what uses, but expending nothing whatever upon the repairs of said bridge, unquote. London Bridge was a marvel of medieval engineering, but it did require constant maintenance. And the city had used the funds it had generated from the bridge to pay for those repairs. But now these were going to the Queen, and the bridge was falling apart. And the Queen, for her part, actually did seem to understand this. As the record of Arnold, our biased little German, says, the Queen, quote, for certain understood that hereby great damage and peril had befallen said bridge. She resigned to the citizens the said custody thereof. And accordingly, in this year, they elected two men as wardens of that bridge, in the same manner as before the Battle of Evesham it used to be kept, unquote. And so Queen Eleanor was about ready to hand it back. But then, suddenly, in 1270, we read that, quote, afterwards, however, within the 15 days next ensuing, the Queen, at whose suggestion I know not, repented of said resignation and abandoned her intention, retaining the said bridge in her own hands, unquote. My, the Queen has suddenly refused to give London Bridge back. Why? Whose suggestion told her to keep it and its funds to herself? Gee, I don't know. Maybe there was someone in charge of London who maybe disliked the city so much that he once blew an entire war so he could kill a bunch of them. Ah, you mean like Prince Edward? Well, technically, it could not have been Edward who suggested she hold on to the bridge for reasons I will say in a bit, but it could well have been the king or anyone who was a close confederate of Edward who advised her. And so she held on to the bridge. And her holding on to the bridge is going to be a big thing. And as I covered all the way back in chapter 29 of the story, where I dedicated an entire chapter to various things about London Bridge, the Queen holding on to the ties of London Bridge, basically for me mean about now, at some point, a certain song is possibly going to be composed by the Londoners. And given how vitriolic London had been towards this woman, well, now London Bridge is falling down, my fair lady, takes on a bit of a darker meaning. Anyway, regardless of that, the records tell us that now, quote, Walter Hervey was made mayor, unquote, and this new mayor, oh, he's going to be a thing. But we're in 1271, and 1271 saw ongoing conflict with the London's neighbours across the sea rise up again, with there being records that, quote, many Flemings found in the city were arrested and kept in custody for some days, in order to be liberated, from which they abjured the realm of England not to return thither, so long as the dispute between the aforementioned should exist between the King of England and the Countess of Flanders, unquote. And the old church dedicated to St. Olaf up on Broad Street, St. Olive Broad Street, was demolished to make a brand new wee priory for the Austin Friars. And as 1272 dawned, we read that, quote, at the end of the month of March died Richard, King of Almaine and Earl of Cornwall, brother of his lordship Henry, King of England, unquote. And with the king's brother dying, it indicated a changing of the guard. 1272, you see, saw something else happen. Walter Hervey was elected for a second term of mayor, and all hell broke loose in the city when he was. And it's such an intense thing, I'm actually going to dedicate an entire chapter to it. But the tumult of the election of the new mayor had to hang on, because the weak and by now senile King Henry III finally passed from this earth in Westminster. And his young and energetic son, Edward, Lord of London, took the throne. Only Edward was not in London. Edward was not even in England. At this exact moment in time, King Edward of England was following the footsteps of his great uncle Richard and was leading men on crusade in the Holy Land. The final great crusade was being waged, and Edward Longshanks was to be in charge of one whole part of it. But so great was the fear and majesty of this brutal heir to the throne, no one even once seriously considered rebelling against him. London had now finally left the reign of King Henry III, and the era of brutal Edward I of England had finally begun. And I'm going to continue that next episode. Oof, thanks for listening. This episode had a lot in it, and I kind of just wanted to get Henry III out of the way. Speaking honestly, I'm a bit sick of the dude. I would like to thank everybody who has stuck with us for 100 episodes. And if they haven't and they've just come along in the journey, thanks anyway. It really means a lot. All the support and kind words I've received over this nearly 2 years or so I've been doing it. And I can't believe I've reached 100 episodes. I really can't. Okay, well, that's enough from me. Thank you for listening. I sincerely and completely hope that you are enjoying this series. And I'm going to carry on. And I look forward to reaching episode 200 at some point. So this is Saul, thanking you all for bearing up and listening to my rather boring voice as I go through the episodes and go through the years as we tell the story of London. Cheers.